Welcome to Conscious Convos. This podcast is a space for conversations that inspire us towards better understanding and achieving spiritual growth. We do that by inviting different guests from all over the world to share their unique journeys, insights, and practical advice on how to live a more elevated and conscious life. This is episode 6, and today we have a very special guest. Zena is a somatic experiencing practitioner who has also taught Qigong on the streets of Beirut. She also still teaches yoga to disadvantaged communities, and the thread that ties all these things together is that they are all forms of healing through movement. So we talk about all this and more stuff on the episode while exploring other questions related to healing traumas and spirituality. So enjoy our conversation with Zena. Here we go. All right. Yep. We're recording now. So hi again, Zena, and thank you so much for being on the Conscious Convos podcast.
That's a pleasure.
The pleasure is all ours. Just to give a little bit of an introduction. So Zena, now for many years, you've been teaching yoga, but with focus on more disadvantaged communities. And at the same time, you have been teaching Qigong. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Qigong. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And recently, or maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, you've also, you got certified in somatic experiencing, and you've been providing sessions for people on somatic experiencing, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a number of different things that you're doing, all, you know, very interesting stuff. That the thing that I find in common between all of them, actually, let me also mention that you're my cousin. So I've known you for yeah. We're cousins. I've known you for most of my life. So that is also another starting point. So all these things, the thing in common between yoga, Qigong, and somatic experiencing is that they're all related to using the body or moving the body in a certain way in order to use the energy or change the energy flow in the body to for healing purposes, for trauma healing, and for generating more inner strength and kindness in especially in the case of yoga. Nice. So all of these things.
I love hearing you trying to synthesize this because we've never actually talked about this before.
Yeah, ever. Yeah.
So it's really exactly. Cool to hear it, like someone else reflecting back, and you know me from a totally different context. That's cool. Mm.
Yeah, I was just thinking about like what's in common between these three things, and
you nailed it.
I'm glad. Okay, and then if I'm missing, if there's any piece of the puzzle I'm missing, you know, you let me know. So this podcast, you know, it's generally on spiritual growth and living consciously, and healing traumas is a very important part. It's an important part of spiritual growth, not only for psychological benefits, which is the obvious thing for healing traumas, but it has spiritual benefits as well, because when you're stuck with traumas, you're living with traumas your whole life, it's going to be an impediment for spiritual growth, because you probably won't be able to connect
with people as well. You won't be able to connect with yourself. Your just general view of life is not the same. Then if you heal the traumas, and then you'll experience life differently, and that helps with spiritual growth. So I haven't gotten to the
Actually,
question.
I'm going to intervene on that point, because the pain of being traumatized is what drives you to seek healing. And in that way, it is a path to into spiritual health rather than an obstacle. I mean, it's, you know, your pain is what drives you into, I need a better solution than whatever this realm is giving me. And that's what actually takes you to look further into something that can give you true freedom. And I mean, healing is so much self-compassion, which is fundamentally a spiritual dimension of yourself, because you're not going to be locked into your ego narratives. You're going to have to step outside of that to heal. So you do step into the spiritual, even if, you know, in different contexts, the word spiritual might not be used. But so there's actually a kind of an intimate dance between trauma and the movement towards spiritual growth.
Very nice, because I've been trying to find the connection between the two, and I like hearing how you described it, that the pain is the driver towards healing. Which,
yeah, I mean, and for people who haven't had something so difficult to deal with, maybe the spiritual path doesn't call them, you know?
Yeah. So I mean, being that I've known you for so long, Zina, and this is what you just mentioned, I know you from a completely different context. Let's start from the beginning. How did you even get interested in this part of, you know, in this world, let's say, of healing and spiritual growth?
You know, I think it's innate. I think it's natural. I think children are born with wonder and like a sense of the spiritual and the invisible and something bigger. And there's no, I mean, when we're born, there's no doubt of it in a way. You know, it's fitra, it's natural. So I think we lose it around adolescence, we lose it around university years, and we get all skeptical and cynical and rebellious, and that's normal part of growth. And then, you know, some people come back to it, some people not, but I think it's actually intrinsic to start with.
Okay.
So, yani, no, I was always very much paying attention to like, how do you call it, like your spirit, the spiritual state, the inner state, not
right.
The outside, not the image, but the inner.
Yeah. So we were together, or we overlapped in university for I think for a year or two, and you were studying history of arts, if I remember correctly. Or was it just history? I'm not sure. But did that have anything to do with it?
My first degree was history, and then my master's was history of Islamic art and archaeology.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was that in any way a doorway that led you to discovering the world of yoga and then Qigong and all that? Okay.
Yeah, in a way, I remember. It kind of all ties up when you look back, because... like growing up in Saudi and going first to a Saudi school, and of course religion is a big part of it. And as a child, I really believed it, and I was terrified of hell. And I remember some teacher telling us that Yom Al Qiyamah is going to be on a Friday. So every Friday I woke up so scared. Was it today?
God.
And like the animals can tell before the humans. So I would go out into the park in the garden and look at the cats. Like, are they picking up the sign that today is Yom Al Qiyamah? I remember that. So I was like reacting, I think, to this fearful approach of teaching Islam. I was reacting to it by learning about the beautiful arts of the Islamic world from, and I mean, I'm critical of the of the field of Islamic art, because it's an Orientalist construct, of course, and it's very much, you know, museums and material things, which is not at all what Islamic civilization is about. But you can't really put yani Sot al-Adhan in a museum in a box in London. You cannot. And that would be truly Islamic arts. Like five times a day, you have an orchestra of calling to God all over the Muslim world, and it goes along with the movement of the sun. It's a beautiful, magnificent, spiritual, civil, social, religious art. And يعني كله مع بعض. Well, it cannot be more beautiful than this. And to me, this captures the whole soul of Muslim civilization, much more than, you know, carved wood and painted ceramics and ivory treasures that are put together as just decorative media. يعني I'm critical of the field, but at least through that field, I was able to see a part of Muslim civilization that's usually not at all talked about in mainstream history lessons. So for me, it was filling in the gaps, because I studied, I grew up in Saudi, so I had a very sort of traditional puritanical understanding of Islam. I went to Beirut and realized, oh, not only are there other sects, there are also Arabs who are not Muslim. Like in Saudi, you don't know this. You know, it's a shock in Saudi. As Syrians, we would know this, but we didn't grow up in Syria. In Syria, of course, we would know this. And so I studied history in AUB to try to understand, because I felt there was so much I didn't understand. But then it was so depressing to study modern history. I liked medieval and late antiquity and all of this. But coming into modern history and the wake of the First World War and Second World, like Kilhaida, where we're still suffering the effects of that era, which is 100 years ago, which in terms of our region's history is not that long ago, it's yesterday. But I mean, we're still living it, the effects of it in our region, right? So out of the pain of that history, I went into art also, because I'm like, I don't want to study history of politics and wars. I want to study history of yani poetry and knowledge and how science grew and how spirituality grew and what kind of debates were people having and what kind of books were people writing and the manuscripts that were painted. And يعني we know قصص ألف ليلة وليلة وقصص جيني and the magic lamp. This idea of stories within stories within stories is so rich and so much more multi-layered than anything the West would describe of us, and we, having been affected by it, would see in ourselves. So a part of it was a reaction to this sort of post-colonial diminishment of who we are.
Right. So that then, you got into history of arts, you saw a different side of Islam that we weren't taught in school. And from there, that led you to learning about yoga during those same years, or did that come later?
Okay, so the yoga connection was, I had the good fortune because when we grew up in Saudi back in the day, the mainstream Saudi schooling was only up, Akif, the American school was only up to grade 9.
Right.
And at some point, I think Faftani Mutawasit, my parents shifted me from the Saudi school to the American school.
That's eighth grade, right? Just for the non-Arabic speakers, that's eighth grade.
Okay. So I shifted into the American school in Saudi, which was only up to ninth grade. So after that, I either go back to the Saudi school or I leave the country. So I went to Damascus and lived with my grandma, whose house was just across the street from the American school. So I would go back and home walking.
I remember.
And in Syria, the American school was really tiny and like a bit of a club, let's say. But I got the good fortune of meeting a wonderful woman who had a huge effect on my life. And she was the music teacher in the school, Deborah Falmouth. And she would teach yoga after class to whoever wanted. And we became lifelong friends until now, because before I knew that she was teaching yoga, I was amazed at how she would look at the students in the eyes. And, you know, people who were attending this American school in Syria, they came from well-off families and they were privileged in many ways. And so, like, some of them, they couldn't care less about studying and they could be really disruptive. And she would just look at anybody with full dignity, with full respect, and ask them, you know, what do you think about so-and-so? Like, no trace of any kind of judgment or rolling the eyes or, come on, guys, settle down. I don't know how she did it. She would just look at people with so much, just looking at their soul, you know? And I was watching, I was like, how is she doing this? Because the same people in other classes were really disruptive. Of course, I was a nerd sitting in the front of the class. But that marked me. And later on, when I came back to Syria to work after I finished college, we met up and I started to join her yoga classes. And she's the one who encouraged me to do yoga teacher training. So somehow that's a continuous thread, because she just looked at everybody with nothing but dignity and like expecting only good things from them. And so that's what would come.
It's fascinating that you know, such encounter could actually have such an impact, a lifetime impact on someone's life, right?
Yeah, totally.
A random teacher, and just because she's very conscious and she looks at you in the eye, this had kind of paved your way into that world.
Absolutely, 100%. And I thank her in my heart every time I step in to teach a class or go in to do some workshop for a community. But every time, every day, she's in my heart, every day.
We gotta reach out to Deborah.
Do reach out to Deborah.
Of course, we'd love to.
Yeah.
So Lina, I don't know, you wanna start in order of, you go.
Yeah, I mean, we could have just had the podcast completely focused on your university life and your education. It sounded very interesting. What you mentioned about the orchestra that happens, you know, with the five prayers, it was just so beautifully articulated and artistic. Like, I feel like I want to hear more of that. And I never actually thought of it this way. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome.
I want to learn about the, is it somatic experiencing?
Yes.
Tell us more about it. What is it? What do you do? What is it catered for?
Yes. So somatic experiencing is, it emerged, it was developed by Dr. Peter Levine in California, who I think he's now in his 80s, and it's his lifelong career of research on body-based psychotherapy. And I think basically it emerged from the recognition that sometimes when people go to psychotherapy and talk about whatever their issues are, and absolutely it's important to talk, there does reach a point where somehow talking isn't able to access the place that's needing help, because it's trauma. And trauma is a survival response in the body. So no matter how much you think about it or understand it or like whatever you try to do with your cognitive brain is not gonna actually reach the trauma, because the trauma is, you know, subcortical. It's in the world where your cognitive brain is not there. It's something instinctive.
Right.
You know, like, and I'm going to give an example that is not a traumatizing example, but it's just to show how the body has its own intelligence before even our mind thinks. Mm-hmm. Like if a bug is flying near my eye, before I even realize what it is, I'm going to turn. And like, there's so much involved, like eyes closed, head turning, the neck is a whole bunch of muscles firing in an instant. Before you have time to register what happened, and maybe afterwards you're like, oh, that was a bug, you know?
Right.
Later on, a few seconds later, the mind will try to take control of the situation. Oh yeah, I know what that was. But actually what protected your eye from whatever insect that was something your body did before you even could think. If you take that power and intelligence and awareness, subconscious, but ever present of the body, and apply it to a life or death situation where huge amounts of energies are going to be called upon because it is a matter of life or death. And that energy is trying to save you, save your life. So it's like when a mother can lift a car to save her child. Normally she can't. But in a trauma situation, there's a huge reserve of energy that comes into play just for that. And ideally, in the natural world, in the wild world, that level of energy gets released right after the trauma is over. You can see it when animals start to shake and shiver and whatever. But humans, being civilized creatures, we don't let ourselves do that. So we'll go through something hugely intense, and then we don't let our body do what it needs to do because we don't understand it. And we're like they actually tell people stop shaking or stop crying, or, you know, they try it. Sometimes they even clasp them rather than let the body release that energy. And so somatic experiencing recognizes this, that trauma is not what happened to you, but it's the remaining energy that didn't get to discharge. And so it's stuck in you. And it's so it is fascinating.
In our previous episode, speaking with Andrea, this is exactly what we were discussing. And here it is again, being basically highlighted, that it's not the actual trauma. It's whether or not you were given the opportunity to completely express the reaction to that trauma, or was some of it basically not given that opportunity, so it basically stays.
Exactly. I mean, definitely trauma is now a much more au courant word than it was before. Like, everyone's talking about it, the awareness of the body is much more understood and accepted than it was even 10 years ago, let alone further back, right? So now people kind of nod their head and say yes. Whereas when it was first said, not so much. And somatic experiencing focuses on the physiology. Like, if I'm nervous, my cheeks are gonna go red. And so feeling the heat of that, for example, is a discharge. I'm not actively expressing it with my words. My body is doing it. Like, okay, I'm nervous, so there's heat coming out of my cheeks, masalan. You know, so a somatic experiencing session will help clients to allow this level of release, where your body is, okay, maybe shaking, maybe sweating, maybe needing to move. I don't know why, but it's needing to move. It's done in a very, very slow way to avoid re-traumatizing and to allow integration. So I would describe somatic experiencing as a specific kind of mindfulness that's tracking body sensation and sense of awareness and connection to safety at the same time, because trauma is a loss of safety, right? If we're traumatized, the world's a dangerous place. Sure. So a lot of what we do is reconnect to what is safe, what is good, because that'll help turn off the alarm system in our body, which is causing the traumatic symptoms. And then we can start to shift. Like, once we have an anchor in what feels safer, we can look to the places that are uncomfortable and still dealing with a traumatic event from the past stuck in our body. But we wouldn't be able to do that without first connecting to safety. So safety is very important.
And how do you provide that to someone that you, a client that you had just met, right? Like,
great question. Yeah. So, like, a lot of safety training to pick up what it is to be safe. You know, chances are the moment here and now is a safe moment. Like right now, us sitting here, chances are it's a safe moment. Anything can happen. We acknowledge this. And we cannot control the world, but chances are the present moment is safe and calm. So we spend a lot of time in the early sessions building awareness of just, you know, okay, I'm sitting on this chair. It's way slowed down. I'm talking a bit too fast to carry the meaning of it. But like, just feel the chair supporting you now, or I'm looking at the glass in my hand. It's here now. I can feel my hand holding the glass. You know, sometimes when we're traumatized, we go numb, we lose this awareness. So just little things like this, very mundane things, in connection with the practitioner,
yes,
creates that sense of safety. It can be a very gradual process if it's totally absent, you know?
Yeah.
And we're not talking about total safety. We're talking about relative safety. Like, is it feeling a little bit better when you just feel the chair supporting your back? I could ask you both now, you know, like take a moment and feel the chair behind you. If you're sitting forward, go ahead, sit back. Does it make a difference? You know, like in your, does something in you feel a little bit more settled by noticing the chair behind you? And things like this is kind of how we work.
Right, and it makes sense actually, because I would think of an anxiety or fear is that you're tapping either into the past or to the future. And so when you kind of bring your awareness and your consciousness to the very presence, you're not basically torn between a memory or a prediction. You're just basically right here, right now. And with that comes peace.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's the key. That's totally the key.
Right. But you just basically mentioned that it's not a one-time session. There are like few sessions when we're talking about somatic experiencing, but then typically a client would come complaining of what? Is it like a physical pain or some emotional trauma, or could they not even be aware of like any of that? Could they just come and be like, I'm not feeling well?
Yeah, it can be anything. So the definition of trauma from the somatic experiencing lens is pretty broad. Basically, anything that triggered your survival response and didn't get resolved. It could be a skiing accident, you tripped and fell on the stairs. There's a moment of impact. A few months later, there's a pain. It doesn't have to be a big thing. That pain, if we give it some attention, spread out the time around the fall, because usually traumatic things are things that have happened too fast. And if only we had a little bit more time, we would have done a better reaction. So the body knows this. The body knows what it would have wanted to do if it had more time. So in the session, we slow down, way, way down, and stretch out time to milliseconds to let the body find what it needed to do that it couldn't do. And that'll resolve, that'll relieve, you know?
Fascinating. So it's just basically creating space for a missed opportunity for that person to basically express what needed to happen.
Yeah, beautifully, beautifully said. Exactly that. Missed opportunity, what needed to happen, what was missing. If only someone else was there, I would have felt better. We use imagination as well, like, okay, we'll pause at this moment, bring in someone else. It could be an imaginary figure. And just to let the body experience that sense of support, protection, presence, witnessing, whatever is needed, you know? Yeah. None of it would be possible if it wasn't slowed down enough and given space. So, I mean, the training to become a somatic experiencing practitioner is 3 years long. And that's just getting started, because you 3 years long to just get fluent with the language and the subtlety of it. And then there's much more to keep learning as you go. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Indeed. Mohammed?
Yeah, no, I think it needs like an episode on its own. But for now, we're touching the surface on a number of things. And then hopefully in the future, we'll get other opportunities to go deeper into all of the things that we're going to just touch on in this episode. But definitely inspires interest in, at least in me, to read up some more on somatic experiencing. I'm curious also about Qigong. Now, it's something I'm a little bit more familiar with it, but I also don't know much. I know that I guess it's a Chinese practice originally. It's been around for maybe 5,000 years or so. Yes. And the words qi gong, qi is what is known as the life energy. Right. And I guess gong means just working with. So it's basically working with this life energy that we all have. through different movements that are done with mostly the arms and different postures, right? This is what
okay.
I know.
Yeah. Then, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Then you can. So
I got exposed to Qigong also through Deborah Felmuth. She's awesome. She was like an amazing school in her own right. So she taught yoga, she taught music, she taught weaving, she taught Qigong. She kind of traveled the world and shared wisdom everywhere she went and learned it everywhere she went.
Where was Deborah from?
She's from the States. She's based in Vermont.
But she was living in Syria at the time?
Yeah, she lived there for about 15 years and married there and has a little apartment in the old town on Straight Street near Bab Touma. So yeah, she speaks Arabic. She's cool. She's cool.
Do you teach it, Zena? Do you teach Qigong or do you just practice it for yourself?
I practice it for myself and I teach the sequence that Deborah taught me because it's a big world, you know. And so I only teach what I've learned and practiced sufficiently to be able to deliver. But I mean, I haven't done any like Qigong teacher training or anything like that. But the sequence that she taught was really beautiful and powerful and different from yoga. So I remember feeling how they're both, both yoga and Qigong are using body movement in a mindful way to promote health. And so yoga, you want to sort of transcend and go beyond. Whereas Qigong, I would say you want to flow with the elements. And it's like medicine with movement. So different kinds of movements are designed very carefully to promote the health of different vital organs. You have for the lungs, for the kidney, for the liver, for the heart. And it's all also in harmony with nature, with the seasons, with the times of day. So certain seasons are suitable for certain organs and certain movements. Springtime has a quality, doesn't it? Like springtime, things are growing, things are shooting up from the ground, things are energetic, and the weather is unpredictable in spring. And so a kind of Qigong practice for spring is very different from, say, winter, when everything kind of subdues, you know, and you're working on deeper strength and you go towards your kidneys, like the back support. Yeah. So it's a very interesting and a lot to learn. I'm still a student, but I teach the sequence, like the teeny little sequence that Deborah taught me is the sequence that I love to teach. Yeah.
I posted a really cool photo of you. The one that's from the website of you on the street, I think in Beirut, doing Qigong.
Very nice.
Awesome.
Actually, there's a story about that because the only reason I started teaching Qigong in Beirut is because the lockdown happened and everything closed. And the streets were empty and people were scared. And unlike yoga, where you need a yoga mat, Qigong, as you said, you're standing and you're sort of connecting to the tree, connecting to the sky, connecting to nature. So it's nice feeling. So we started to teach it in the street just regularly every single day for about 3 months in the neighborhood where I live, Balhamra, as a symbol of, you know, we're okay, we can still do something beautiful and healing, even when the world is going crazy and everyone's terrified. You can keep your masks on, you can have your distance. For once, there's no traffic in Hamra. So people could like really, you know, occupy the streets, like we occupied the neighborhood in a very like gentle, slow movement. And it was funny, people, hafzuna, and there they go again.
For those who don't know, it's usually a super crowded area in Beirut, for those that don't know,
yes,
like filled with people, cars, traffic jams all the time. So I can only imagine what it would look like when it's empty and in slow motion, people doing Qigong movements, and everybody was out in the streets, or people like also watching from their windows
The streets were empty. I mean, not a lot of people were on the streets, but us who live in the neighborhood were like, okay, every day at six, it's just 20 minutes, breathe in, breathe out.
Yeah.
You know, like gentle movement, and everyone would go back home feeling so much better and like happier and uplifted. It was great. So that's why I was like, Qigong became the more suitable thing to do.
And that was spontaneous, right? That was just done spontaneously. You started to do it at a specific time every day, and people started to expect that at that time every day, okay, there's a Qigong thing going on.
I mean, I didn't post anything about it or write anything about it because it was lockdown and people had to stay home. Yeah, nobody was allowed to move anyway.
Right.
So it was just word of mouth, or whoever saw from the window or whoever happened to walk by could join. There was no publicity about it whatsoever.
Isn't it amazing how sometimes you put so much effort into organizing something on purpose and it doesn't work out so well? Right. And other times, things like this that are just, you know, spontaneous on the spot, you decide to do it, you know, very naturally and organically, people just join in.
Yeah. Crazy.
And
I would encourage whoever would join to start their own circle wherever they are, you know, like, because I mean, you know, we were just a small group in Hamra, it would grow and shrink, right. But yeah, I mean, organically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of me going around, no, go ahead and start. Like, let it spread. Bring beauty into your neighborhoods while the streets are empty. You know, it's good.
Amazing. I mean, you know, something I think about, I was thinking about it yesterday, Zaina, how the concept of this life energy that is a chi, okay? It's been known for centuries in many other cultures. We were never taught it in school. And right. I didn't grow up knowing there was anything called chi or life energy. You know, we were taught everything except that. Even though when we think about it now, it's such an obvious concept. Like it seems like it's undebatable now that we have something flowing in us called life energy. And this, if it's flowing well, we're healthy, and otherwise we're not. I mean, why do you think such a concept was not available to us when we were growing up? And even until today, if I mention it to my, for example, to my parents, they wouldn't be that accepting of it, or.
Right.
You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, these do come from Far East cultures, like Qigong comes from China and yoga comes from India. So they are coming from different cultures. And maybe in our part of the world, the heritage that we have is a bit different. So we have sort of the Greek science, the Arab science, the sort of Mediterranean culture, that kind of thing where, I don't know, I'm thinking Plato and Aristotle and that whole debate between the ideal realm and the material realm. So like it was a different kind of debate, a different kind of science. There is such a thing as, you know, science in different cultures. I think one of the earliest non-Hindu scholar of yoga was actually a Muslim scholar from the Abbasid period. Let me remember his name, Al-Biruni, or something like 9th century. And he did a study of it was like, he's like, you know, a comparative religion kind of person. Like he studied Judaism and the details of Judaism, how they understand the world. He studied the same thing for Hinduism. And he would say, yeah, this, you know, this part fits with Islam, this part doesn't, but he would put them all there, like very scientifically, objectively, respectfully, and like say, from a Muslim perspective, this is not appropriate, but he would say for them, this is what they believe. Like he would understand it from their perspective and hold to his own. Very, very interesting scholar, this guy. He
so
did a lot of research about it.
That's the first guy, you know, that's from our, let's say, from the Middle Eastern or Arabic or Islamic heritage that discussed these things.
And this is like 1,200 years ago.
Yeah, right.
It's there. What is similar to yoga from the Muslim world is Sufism. So like, yani if Sufism is kind of like the fringe of Islam, it's the starting point of yoga, yani where they take Sufism as the starting point and go from there. In the Muslim perspective, we take Sufism as, I mean, and I'm speaking very, very, yani superficially, yani I'm not, ما بعرف الأد بس مفهومي, my understanding of it is like the spiritual, because both of them, yoga is a spiritual practice fundamentally. It also has benefits for well-being. In Islam, we say العقل السليم في الجسم السليم, you know,
healthy mind and healthy body.
We have, yani the idea of well-being has so much to do with good intention, with affirmation, which is in the heart of Islam, al-amal fi al-niyat. So we do have this awareness of the power of thought. We do have this apparent awareness of the importance of intention in everything you do and in being sincere. And sincerity is alignment of your energies. Like if lack of sincerity creates disalignment in your energy. So there's something, we have a different language for it. We have a different approach for it. We come from the heart and from the sincerity side rather than from, you know, I'm improving the vital flow of my organs or I'm transcending, you know, it's
right. It's like the goal is the same, but the language is different, basically.
Yes, because health is health. Yeah, health is health. Being صحة وعافية وسلامة, like, I like the word people translate peace as salam, but salam is wholeness. Yani salam, salh salim, we say, like something is whole. It's not bent out of shape. It's salim, salam, salim.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting in that way.
Yeah. A lot to think about and a lot to digest there. Seriously.
I mean, your questions are great. I haven't thought about these things, so it's making me like.
It's a lot of, and sometimes I reflect on these things, and it's, I mean, this is what also the podcast is for, because I like throwing around these ideas, and I always wonder what other people think about some of the questions that I have in my mind. Sometimes I find answers to these questions just on my own or from reading. Sometimes I don't, and I just. And it's really fascinating hearing other people's perspectives. Sometimes I've realized that discussing these things, you reach realizations in the moment, yeah. Like right then and there, you say something and it's like, oh, I just said this and I never actually thought about it before, but here we are, we reached, and I love it when that happens.
Yeah, I'm totally feeling it because I didn't know what I was going to say until you asked. It's really cool.
Awesome. That's a good sign. Lena, I know you wanted to ask something.
I wanted to get to the core of this episode.
We're still at the core.
I know, we haven't even touched it.
Okay.
And that kind of reflects my life as well. I don't have like a core thing. I kind of do many things. So it's okay.
And it's been really, really wonderful. Everything that you had shared has been really, really nice. But honestly, we wanted to bring some focus on the work that you do with the unprivileged communities and the refugees.
Yeah.
Mo mentioned that you practice yoga with them. And I just find this to be very fascinating because, you know, in such a transactional world that we live in, for you to do that with these communities, I just find it to be fascinating. And I want you to give us, to tell us more about it. So how did you get to do this work? Where are they based? Do you do it with males, females? Like, I want to know everything about it.
Yeah, okay. I mean, most of the refugee communities that I've had the privilege of working with are around Lebanon. Some of them I've met with online and they're in Za'atari camp. I usually work in collaboration with different NGOs who are interested in supporting the well-being of refugee communities. And so I come in and I teach some yoga, and I really feel that there's an image in people's minds of yoga, because it's become this commercial multi-million billion dollar business world, where it's like, you know, yoga pants and yoga pose and yoga photo. I'm like, that's not yoga. That's not what yoga is about, you know? Like, yoga is about service. Yoga is about making the world a better place and helping where help is needed. And really, I mean, the original yogis were doctors and physicians who lived a very poor and humble life and went to the most downtrodden places in their communities and sat there and served and helped. You know, that's actually yoga, but now it's something else. So people's, the imagination around what is yoga doesn't match
the reality.
Oh, we're going to teach yoga to a group of refugee women, like, huh? But I know originally that's what it would have been, right? And I mean, I've only started doing this around 2015. And I admit, like, the first time I went, I was like, how am I going to do this? Because, like, it's intimidating to come out of your comfort zone, yani.
Sure.
And how to see the loss, see the pain, like, really, those glasses need to be removed, really. Like, it's so much down to human dignity, you know. This is what, to me, spirituality is dignity and freedom. Dignity and freedom. And every person, every creature is born with this right, you know? And so nobody wants to be labeled a refugee or labeled anything. Nobody wants to be stuck under a label. So it took a few times to clear my eyes from that. Yeah, and yoga helps a lot in this, because you're addressing the part inside each person that is untouched by anything. Like, that's what you're addressing in a yoga class. You're addressing the part that's untouched, untouchable, absolutely pure and strong and pristine. And nobody else does that. And who else is gonna look, address a group from that place, you know? Simply by addressing from that place, it starts to evoke change. And it's usually, I mean, again, I think of Deborah, because, like, we were all a bunch of spoiled kids, and she looked at us with so much dignity.
Yeah.
You know, and it made us connect to ourselves. Same thing, people who've been through horrible things, don't let them be stuck under the label of their horrors. Nah, there's still the dignity of their spirit, of their dreams, of whoever it is. No, ma'am, it could happen to anyone. Nobody is protected in this world. But we can, yani, yoga helps to address that part of us that is untouchable. And usually simple things, just moving the joints, because, you know, when you're traumatized, you lose connection to your body. And so joint movement helps to really start to get the energy flowing. Toe bending, it could be a whole bunch of toe bending. This is hugely important. Just flex your toes and point your toes, you know, things like this. And coming in with a...
How receptive were they in the beginning, Zaina? Were they immediately open to it, or was there some resistance in the beginning?
You have mixed crowd. So, I mean... I can't generalize, but I did notice that for many of them, even though they're coming from conservative societies, they would take it and, oh, it's like Islam. Oh, ma, when we pray, we also do these kinds of movements. Yani, right. They took it with familiarity rather than, oh, this is strange. So right. It was fine.
And was it something that they learned and you felt that they were going to keep doing even when you're not there? So, like, the yes. The benefit they got was long term?
Yes, absolutely. This is the whole point. And right now, I mean, we started in 2015. Right now, we're doing a yoga teacher training. That's a year-long training for the ones who are with us long enough to be able to hold that kind of space, and they can be teachers in their communities.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It is. I'm so humbled by it. And I'm really grateful for the organization that's really making this happen. It's called Tools for Inner Peace, completely volunteer run, and really, like, really, really most beautiful people that it just dignity and freedom, you know.
Sorry, what are they called? What are they called again?
Tools for Inner Peace.
You shared the link already, I think, with me earlier on, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Tools for Inner Peace, because I'm gonna make sure that I mention them in the notes for the episode. Okay.
Oh, please do, because I mean we are volunteer based completely, but we would totally welcome donations to that effect, because our year long training was budgeted according to the Lebanese lira a few months back, and its prices have quadrupled since then, and we haven't raised our prices at all. I mean,
right?
It's $30 per weekend, and you can pay $15 or nothing at all, depending on where you're coming from, because, you know, so like full scholarships are being given, but what we had budgeted for was according to a few months back. And so the prices have changed suddenly on us.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure we'll be able to manage it, but any donation will be great.
It sounds like they're doing some amazing work, and we would love to give them some more exposure. So
Thank you. Absolutely
we'll mention that. Lena, I think I interrupted you again. I'm so sorry if I did.
No, not at all.
Right.
Go ahead if you have any more questions.
We agreed earlier, Lena and myself, that we're going to interrupt each other during the podcast to just make it not be afraid of interrupting each other if we both have a question at the same time.
Yeah,
I love that. I'm curious to know what your experience in yoga has been like. What takes you guys to yoga? Assuming you do yoga, I don't know.
I don't, so I have nothing to say about that.
Oh, really? Okay, I would love to offer you guys a lesson.
Would love that. I mean, I tried it before. I did. Yeah. I tried it before, but and it was wonderful, but for at least in a phase in my life, I was more inclined with martial arts.
Oh, yes.
So I did that for a few years. But then after I got married, became a mother, I think yoga would have worked best for me then, because, you know, you can't really do martial arts while you're pregnant, but you can do yoga while you're pregnant. So I started martial arts, but never went into yoga. But
I think all of these can be adaptable. I mean, you know, traditionally women weren't allowed to do yoga, aslan, let alone pregnant women. Yeah. Traditionally women were not allowed. Now it's considered a woman dominant field, but traditionally it was men only and very secretive.
Wow. I had no
idea. Yeah. It's the world of yoga has gone many transformations.
Wow.
In recent times, only since I would say the 70s or maybe 60s.
It sounds like, Zaina, that the impact of that work, the work that you did with these communities, as positive it was for them, it sounds like it also had a huge impact on you and on yourself.
Yeah, it's my happiest time of the week when I'm going to
you do still do workshop. It. You're still doing it. It never stopped.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are you doing now, Zaina? I mean, what's what are your short-term plans, medium, long-term, what if you feel like revealing anything?
So, I mean, I've been based in Dubai only a year and a half, so I haven't been based here long, and I still go back and forth to Beirut often for the sake of these workshops. So my sister has been based here for 5 or 6 years already, and we're thinking of doing something together. Stay tuned.
Okay. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. But definitely in the spirit of promoting health and wellness in a holistic way,
right.
bringing in all the different wisdoms from different places together. Yeah.
Awesome. Zena, a question just popped in my head, as usual. Just reflecting on this, you know, entire episode and everything that we discussed, sometimes I wonder, how is it that there are people that go through life in its entirety almost, not doing not yoga, not meditation, no Qigong, nothing, and they seem fine, while for me, for example, if I go one day without meditating for at least 10, 15 minutes, I feel like something's off. And I feel like I need to do something to feel grounded and to feel more balanced again. Is it something that is different from one person to another? Is it something different from generation to another? Is it because we're living in a more stressful time than other generations? I don't know. But, you know, we all know a lot of people that don't have in particular any spiritual practice, and they seem fine. You know, it seems like they're good and they're happy, and I'm really happy for them. How how do they do it, but why is there such a difference between people and how much we need these practices in our lives? And I'm someone that needs, I feel like I need a lot.
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, people are different.
Yeah.
I kind of look at it like, I have a friend, for example, who's always very emotional and like falling in love left, right, and center and drama. And I'm like, how does she do that? So not me, you know? Like, people have different proclivities. Right. Like, some are more spiritually inclined, some are more drama driven, some are more, I don't know. Achievement. I mean, it's different drives. I think maybe have you heard of the Enneagram model? That could be an interesting topic for an upcoming talk.
I have heard of it, but I don't know much about it. So
yeah,
it kind of
tries to categorize sort of different motivations that people have that kind of define them in a way. But yeah, it's also fluid. I mean, I don't think that there are people who are without worry and anxiety or of some sort in their life. Whatever concerns you will concern you at whatever level you're at.
Mm. I think,
and if
I
you're
think,
happy, you're happy. I mean, that's the point, isn't
right.
it?
I think everybody is spiritually inclined because everybody in their essence is a soul. And everybody in life, they're trying to connect to their soul in one way or another, but they just connect differently. So while, you know, some of us connect through meditation, other people find that same connection when they do sports, like when they do very intense exercising, they have spiritual experiences. And other people, they might feel the same thing while doing their job that they love in a very focused and loving way. When they're in the moment, they might get that same fulfilling experience, the same one that we're looking for, right, while we're doing yoga or Qigong or something else. So maybe this is the answer that I came up with. It could be that.
I think I agree. I mean, there are many ways. Many ways. All roads lead to Rome.
Right.
I remember a few years ago, I had an appointment. This might sound like a bit irrelevant, but I promise you, I'm going to get into the core of the subject here. But a few years ago, I went to a dentist to do just like a general checkup. And although I wasn't complaining of anything, she said, you know, you're here already. Let's just do an x-ray just to make sure that everything is okay. She did an x-ray only to realize that I actually had an abscess under one of my...
Ouch.
Yeah. But it was dormant, so I had no symptoms whatsoever, nothing. I was complaining of nothing. She recommended that I actually go through the cleaning process because she said you can never tell when it's actually, if it's going to stay that way forever or if it starts acting out. So I had agreed to her suggestion, and that was a week of hell. Of opening and draining the abscess, and like my face got swollen and I was in so much pain. But back to your question, Mohammed, you know, I think that a lot of people might seem fine, but I think that healing, when we open that door for healing, it could be very messy.
Yeah.
A lot of people might have not opened that door yet.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that every healing that happens has to be messy. But I mean, look at what has been happening in the world. This insanity, yeah. That, like with everything that's going on. But this is how healing looks like. It was told to me by my teacher. And I totally understand it now on a physical level that healing could look very messy. Because you're bringing a lot of these traumas to the surface and you're dealing with it. And maybe... those who seem to be fine right now, maybe they just haven't tapped into that, or maybe they did and they're done with it. But I think being and living life, you gotta have a taste of that one way or another, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
I fully agree with that, Lena, totally. I mean, healing is work. It's work.
It is.
It's not like a breeze, yani. It's it's painful. And a lot of people don't want to go into it. They're like, no, I just want to stay in the light.
Right.
It's not good. You know?
Yeah. No, that's a very cool insight, Lena. I totally agree with that. Zaina, should people still contact you for somatic experiencing? Do you still do consultations, or you stopped?
I do consultations online on Zoom.
How can they reach you?
Honestly, I have on my website, because I've been based in Beirut since 2011, and so my coordinates are there. And to be honest, most of my clients are based in Lebanon and sort of catering to that crisis. My position in Dubai is a bit different.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of trying to straddle both worlds.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking, because I know you're sort of in a transitional phase right now. So
yeah.
It's still, so they can still go to your website, which I'll post.
Yoga with Zaina.org.
Yeah, I was just looking for it here. And there's your, I don't know, it's an email or a contact form or some.
Yeah, there's a WhatsApp or an email, message. I don't tend to answer calls because I'm usually in session or somewhere in a workshop. So messages are the best way.
Okay. Very cool. We'll make sure to post that. No, we will. We'll post that. Absolutely. Awesome. So I think that is a good segue to end it. Lena, do you got any more?
Question.
I forgot about that.
Our guests.
Please go for it.
To share with us a person or a book. I know you've already mentioned Deborah. And I gotta say, the seed that Deborah planted had flourished beautifully, because you're a beautiful example of that seed, and you're replicating what she has done to you, and it's just so wonderful.
Honestly, I feel I'm channeling her every time I'm in that zone. I'm channeling Deborah. Wallahi, it's so.
Are you on Instagram by any chance? Are you in touch with her? Do you have any?
Yes.
Okay, please, maybe we'll get her.
That would be amazing.
Sure.
That would be wonderful.
Okay, be like, cool. Deborah, check this episode out. Don't miss it. You were with us.
Super.
We're gonna do
it. Any books that you recommend, something or someone that had influenced you greatly?
Well, I mean, at the moment, so I have two books at hand. One is this Ibn Arabi, The Tree of Being. And I like it because it's looking at spirituality from a Muslim perspective. And then tapping into my art history background, I have this amazing book that's looking at the history of architecture in Dubai with a good sensitivity to the history of the region. So like a really macro view.
Nice
showpiece.
It's a serious piece of research. Beautifully written, though the language is gorgeous, by Todd Rice.
Okay. Showpiece. Sorry, the first one was called what again?
Ibn Arabi, The Tree of Being.
The Tree of Being. Wow, yeah. Very interesting title. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was nice to read it for Ramadan.
Did you manage to finish it all?
In Ramadan? I'm about halfway.
You're halfway. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, Zena. It was an awesome episode. Really, really
it's
enjoyed
my
it.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for hosting me. It's so good to have these conversations. What an awesome podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. All right. So we'll keep in touch and hopefully we'll have you on again,
Zena. With pleasure. With pleasure.
Because I always...
if you do want to contact Deborah, I swear I'll love to make that happen.
Sure. We will talk about it. After I hit the stop button, we'll talk about all these little details. Okay, all right. Yeah. Thank you, everybody that's listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you in the next one. Take care.
Goodbye. Ciao.